Mike O'Mara, Radio Entertainment. Informed, intelligent, irreverent, political persuasions with Mike O'Mara and Chris Frates. And now, here's Mike.
Please release me, let me go.
All right, I know that you, Chris Frates, and you work with Rob Spiewak to surprise me on a weekly basis with these stunning musical renditions. I'm my brain now right out. Maybe it's a good way to get me thinking, because right away I'm beginning to think. Well, okay, release me, let me go. No one was released from North Korea this week. Yeah, we have.
Although, what are the Democrats calling on President Trump to do?
Quit.
In addition, release the
Release the memo.
Release the, we have a whole nother memo, brouhaha.
Like a longer memo. Like so a 10-page memo.
So this was a Rob Spiewak special. I don't think Engelberg Humperdinck has ever led a show. But also, just Engelberg Humperdinck. Like, that's just so fun to say.
Welcome to Political Persuasions. I'm Mike O'Mara, along with Chris Frates. And early on in the show, when we were taping these shows, it was brought to my attention that Mr. Frates, who is a younger man than I, requested a slightly hipper style of music to begin the. And there's nothing that says hip than more than Engelbert Humperdinck.
It wasn't so much hipper, but just different. I mean, it was like you had to drum in.
Topical.
Yeah, something topical. I like our bumper music to surprise our listeners. And then we usually go out with one, which we don't talk about. And that's for our listeners to kind of guess on, well, what's that about? I think they.
All right, well, Chris, here it is. I think that both you and Rob are going to need to be chaperoned. That's the way I look at this with this type of situation.
We will sneak out of the house. It doesn't matter.
As usual, one of the great things about doing this show, there is no shortage of material to bring to you. And, of course, we decided that we would start. We wouldn't start with Memogate.
No,
we wouldn't start with with
Let's
the White House Chief of Staff John Kelly. We're going to start with the parade.
I'd like a parade. The way I understand it, Mr. Frates, is that I went over to France. I saw the Bastille Day parade. That was just incredible. All
so
the
many
tanks. All the tanks. By the way,
so
the
much
tanks,
hardware.
My favorite part of the parade. Look, this is just. I think people in this country from the left, myself included,
right,
can practically hear the arguments already. We can practically hear the slander of us not being patriotic Americans because we don't want a parade. But geez, here he goes.
I mean,
and it's no surprise he wants to have the Soviet style. Goose stepping in the streets, military parade, and he doesn't have a sense of history or a sense of world affairs that would govern him, govern his little orange brain in such a way that would say, this is really going to make us look like a dictatorship. He likes a dictatorship. That's what he likes, isn't it?
He likes a good strong man. He likes a good show of force. He doesn't like weakness, Mike. And so that's, and I kind of agree with you on this one. You know, oftentimes I'll say,
Mike,
the other side is XYZ. And I will say that this one really does rankle me a little bit. We've not won a war. In fact, we still are at war in Afghanistan. And Iraq, we've not pulled out of either one of those countries. It's the longest war in the history of our country. So there's really nothing to celebrate in terms of bringing our troops home. I like a good troops home as much as anybody kind of parade. The last one we had was Desert Storm.
I should point out to you, Chris Frates, that I am a parade fan. I like St. Patrick's Day parades. I like Memorial Day parades. I grew up in a town that had a Memorial Day parade every year. I like the Shriners parade that they had in Hartford, Connecticut.
I like a parade, too. In fact, I am missing one right now because the Eagles Super Bowl parade is today, and I'm here taping this.
Are you an Eagles fan?
Oh, my God, yes. A thousand times, yes.
You're sacrificing the trip to the parade.
Yes, for this show, for our listeners.
Oh, my God. Where the fans will be on the street eating cow poop and,
all right.
and hanging
First
from
of all,
light
it
poles.
Was horse poop. And second of all... That's not everybody.
Oh, my God. Fly, Eagles, fly. Dude, what a game. Congratulations. That was a great game.
I mean, if you're a fan of football, you had to love that Super Bowl.
I'm not only a fan of football, but I will tell you that I rooted for your team in the Super Bowl. I thought it was
the only time, I think I said this last week, the only time that the Philadelphia Eagles could be known as America's team.
Because it was I would give you probably one of the top five Super Bowls that I've seen. You usually, you know, and really we're getting to a point now where the Super Bowl rap of having bad football games is going by the by. Because the fact is, we've had some good contests in the Super Bowl. It's gotten exciting. Big finishes. That was no exception. It was really, really great to see.
I remember last year with the Falcons Patriots, and everybody was writing off, you know, the Patriots. And I said, oh, no, do not turn this game off. You need to watch the last 2 minutes. And then they came back, despite me rooting for the Falcons. Because, I mean, you got to root against the Pats, right?
No, congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
By the way, as someone who was a long-suffering Red Sox fan, and the first time they won a World Series, the parade is fun to watch because you see your heroes marching through the street, but it's not like the parade we're talking about. And here's, I want to throw this out at you, because there are certain things that are becoming irrefutable and obvious to most thinking Americans. And the fact is that when you think of military-style parades, you think of dictatorships. You think of Soviet.
You think of North Korea. Right.
China does it right there. With that said, the quote that I love came on. I think I was watching Colonel Jack Jacobs, Medal of Honor recipient. Being in a parade stinks. For the troops. He talks about the fact that they'd rather have civilians parade and they could eat popcorn and be drinking beer and watching the civilians parade, because the organization of one of these military parades for the troops is a drag. It's a multi-hour commitment where they're out there and it's just not. So what does it come down to? Who is this for? Well, we all know who it's for. It's for the man that doesn't have a perspective and can't be told that, well, if you do this and you're not in a troops coming back from a major conflict situation, you're really duplicating communist dictatorships. And it's just the hits keep on coming. But his base is going to lap it up. His base is going to say, this is fantastic. And that makes me sad.
So I have a couple thoughts on this. This story to me looked like your classic trial balloon. That somebody who was against it inside the military, because it came from the post-military writers. So somebody inside the Pentagon was like, oh, this guy's talking about a parade. Let's throw it out there. Try to kill it. It has gotten bipartisan condemnation. My favorite quote from a Republican.
Widespread bipartisan condemnation, do you think?
I don't know if it's widespread yet, because a lot of these, and we can talk about this as well. Michael Gerson had a great piece in the Washington Post. He's George W. Bush's former speechwriter, so a Republican establishment guy who said that Republicans have basically sold themselves out to Trump and they have no moral fiber. So he sounded a lot like Mike O'Mara on the page of the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. But GOP Senator Kennedy from Louisiana was asked if the parade was a good idea. He said this. He said, quote, "No, I think confidence is silent and insecurity is loud. America is the most powerful country in all of human history. Everybody knows it, and we don't need to show it off."
I think, totally agree with that.
I think that is true. There is a argument to be made, and you kind of touched on it at the top there, where Republicans who are for this are going to say, well, you know, the critics and the Democrats are anti-military. And I have seen a little bit of, is it a, you know, throw Brer Rabbit in the briar patch kind of thing? No, don't throw me down there, because you do end up criticizing the military. Trump can turn that on you and then run on, I'm a military guy. I love our military. I celebrate our military. And the military is one of the few institutions that still has huge approval ratings in our country. You know, the media sucks, the government sucks, but the military, better approval ratings. It could be politically a smart way to position himself. However you feel about the parade itself, it kind of runs into that issue.
And I think maybe, once again, maybe they're – I don't think he thinks it through like that. I think that it ultimately results in that. Or maybe he does think it through like that, because everybody can – you can make a lot of arguments about Donald Trump, but the fact is he is a somewhat savvy manipulator of the media, and I think that could get there. Where I come down with this is with the expense of a parade. I think in terms of what could you really do with $12 million that would go to a parade for people in the military? What kind of bonus could you offer them? What kind of gifts could you offer them? Yeah, what kind of incentives could you offer them? It just goes on and on and on. And it's just, to me, once again, another distraction in this chaos college that is the Trump administration, where this goes on and on and on. And, you know, as you mentioned last week on the show, there's a limited amount of time to actually really create something and pass legislation in the United States government. And you already indicated the first year is pretty important, and we've gotten by that. Now maybe it's just distract. And what's interesting about it is you're seeing it kind of on both sides with this government shutdown once again looming, and whether or not there's an agreement, and whether the conservatives don't like it, the far left doesn't like it, the far right doesn't like it. But meanwhile, the last thing in the world I think that this administration should be doing is planning a parade.
Well,
it's just not to do this.
I don't think there's much else for them to do, Mike. To your point, I think we're going to
really
see.
So the ship has sailed as far as real achievements.
I think the last piece of real legislating you're going to see this year is this budget deal that looks like the Republicans and Democrats are hammering out as we speak. Mm-hmm. It will keep the budget operating. It'll lift the debt ceiling. For folks who don't know what the debt ceiling is, it's basically think about your credit card and your debt limit, and when you usually come up against it, you call them up, and it's always on stuff we've already bought. So when conservatives talk about, oh well, we need to, you know, not raise a debt limit, it's like, well, we already did that spending, so we need to pay for it. But
and
the point being,
what is causing that debt ceiling to explode? Oh, that's right, the tax cuts.
Well, no, because they the tax cuts haven't gone into effect yet. This is we've already hit the debt limit.
They are, Chris, and they're going to expand the national debt. That's what's going to
Two separate issues.
All right, okay, all right. I just felt like yelling.
I know. I appreciate like it. I appreciate it. But
what's
the point?
How are they two? Explain that, because I like to be educated. Two separate issues.
So you are correct that the debt will continue to expand, but they need to approve the debt limit. They need to raise it. So they essentially, the Congress needs to say, yes, we are going to continue putting stuff on our credit card. Right. And
that's the immediate problem.
That's the immediate problem. And then that allows for the debt that the tax cuts will bring us.
Right.
To be accrued. Right.
There are no tax cuts if they don't raise the national debt.
Well, the tax cuts.
If they don't raise the.
Yeah, the problem is there would be tax cuts, and then we would end up, you know, in a position where we could default on our loans because we would be out of money to pay.
But
our
the
debts.
Point is, when you know, one of the things that you're going to have by increasing this debt ceiling and allowing the government to continue to function is when that goes through, and if it's a 2-year plan, you pay for things that we don't have the money to pay for anything, and we're using our, as you like to call it, credit card debt to pay for these things. And you know, when you're talking about Republican administration, it always seems they're talking about tax cuts. When you're talking about Democratic administration, it seems like we always talk about entitlement programs. Both things raise raise the debt, not the debt ceiling, but the debt.
Well, the other thing,
which is in the trillions of dollars.
And there's something else at play here, Mike, that I think is a fundamental shift for Republicans that we've not seen before. Going back to 2011, you might remember something called the Super Committee, right? And this was a bipartisan committee that came together to try to figure out how
they all wore spandex, didn't they?
It was very sexy.
They were super.
They were super. Yeah, they capes and spandex. It was
all right, very good.
Yeah, so
here I come to save the day. I'm the Super Committee. All right, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I don't mean to
No, no, no. I
what I do.
It is the best part. So they come together with this sword of Damocles. Thank you, Rob.
Damocles.
That's one thing I.
I don't know. Might be getting the flu. I'm sorry.
Hanging over their head that if they don't come to an agreement, they're just going to automatically bring spending down. And nobody wants that because it was going to cut military spending. It was going to cut domestic spending. And the thought was, okay, well, let's not just have draconian cuts. Let's come to a agreement that we can all get on board with to do this in a meaningful, rational way. Well, guess what happened? They didn't do it. And those cuts came into place, and that's called sequestration. And so that's something that has been happening since.
My brain's hurting with all this.
I know, dude. Crap. That's why you bring me on the show.
Sequestration. Give me two sentences for sequestration.
They were across-the-board budget cuts and caps on how much Congress could spend. Basically, Congress was like, well, if we can't figure this out, we need, you know, automatic cuts and spending caps so we don't go over those limits. Well, of course, the first thing that Congress starts to do is, well, let's pass legislation to go over these limits. And so they have been challenged by that, you know, almost every year, but they've kind of hewed to it. In this budget deal that's happening, they are basically busting these caps. So both Democrats and Republicans got on board to say, hey, you know what? Let's not cap military spending on the Republican side. And then the Dems said, okay, well, if you don't want to cap military spending, then domestic spending needs to be uncapped too. Republicans said, hey, that's great. Let's do it. That is a fundamental shift for Republicans. Remember, Republicans ran and they won on Tea Party. Anti-government spending, too much spending, Obamacare spending, the Democrats are spending,
conservative
spending, spending.
Mantra.
It's that, a conservative that, that, mantra. Know, now they control everything, and they're like drunk sailors. And so that was the thing that is so shocking to me.
They always
in
talk
this
about the tax and
deal.
Spend Democrats, and what you have now are the tax cut and spend Republicans.
Correct.
And it's you know, ultimately, and I do listen. I understand the conservative viewpoint that down the road, that at some point. We're going to come up against, seriously come up against it. And it might be our kids or our kids' kids, but it just cannot be done. And it has been proven, has it not? I think back to the Clinton administration, where you can achieve a balanced budget. You can get there, but it's tough.
It's
and
hard.
No one wants to say no. Nobody wants to say no to donors. Nobody wants to go back to their district and
well,
say,
and this,
I'm sorry, we
and
can't
And this
do
comes
that.
Down to the bipartisan system, right? Because Republicans would be happy to increase military spending and cut domestic spending and just say, okay, well, that's how we're going to, you know, we will spend more in the military, and to do that, we'll cut domestic spending. Democrats stand there and say, no way. You can't cut these programs that, you know, that help Americans. And so that is where you get that push-pull from D's and R's, because they both want what they want in increased spending.
And the bottom line,
and nobody
and
wants to cut anything.
Can I tell you how I look at it? And yeah, you can say tax and spend. But the fact is that when you are talking about, and I know it's not the very, very wealthy that are going to be able to take care of this problem with an increase on their taxes. I know that. I know that you have to spread the pain a little more widely than that. But I think the realistic thing to do, no one in politics wants to come out and be frank with the American people and be honest with the American people and tell them, in order to get what you want and to have a strong military and to have a good health care program and to have programs that benefit the least fortunate in our society, you're going to have to, the people that have are going to have to experience some pain. That doesn't make me a socialist or a communist. That makes me somebody who I think is a realist, where if we don't do that, then you're going to argue. You're going to come up against these debt ceilings, and it's just going to go on and on and on. And I think it's valuable to take a great hard look at entitlement programs. And it's valuable to take a great hard look at where these military dollars that have been abused so much over the years are going. Everything is, we have been so lost in our politics and our divisiveness that it's just not done in a bipartisan way anymore, is it?
It's not. And if you want to budget, if you want to balance the budget, what you have to do, and experts agree on this across the board and across ideologies, is you have to raise taxes and cut spending.
And in some way. It doesn't have to be income taxes. It can be a national sales tax. It can be
right.
a flat tax. There are lots of options, but that just seems
right,
to always be lost in the shuffle.
Well, the other piece of that you were not hitting on very hard is Democrats don't want to cut anything. I mean, mm-hmm. they don't want to cut, you know, an increase to Social Security. That's, you know, it was a modest proposal, you know, a few years ago, and they were against it. They were against any cuts to those things. So when you have Dems
when you
on one hand,
when you talk about Social Security, though, you're talking about something that is so relevant, and the dollars are so small comparatively that when you talk about something like Social Security. There, don't you think there are other programs and other entitlements that not only can be cut, but perhaps can be looked at and manage, maybe micromanage more, where you can find the
because,
fat
because,
in some of these
because
programs.
You're wrong about that, because discretionary spending is the smallest part of the budget. The entitlements and military spending are the biggest. They are two-thirds of the entire budget. So
entitlements,
Medicare, right. Medicaid, and Social Security, they are the biggest drivers of domestic spending, and they are all entitlement programs. So you have to look at entitlements. And you don't have to look at, you know, cutting people now. You can look at cutting me in 25 years, and I can plan on that, right? But there's no discussions about
that. What about cutting me in 10 years?
You probably, if you're too old, you know.
I'm 72. I'm too old? What?
No, in terms of being, like, you're, what, 55, right? Like,
shut up, Chris.
They wouldn't come... They wouldn't come at you. They wouldn't come at you, right? Because one, you're definitely going to vote, because older Americans vote more so than younger Americans do.
Called me old. That's the second time in this paragraph you've called me old.
I mean, look, you are ARP eligible. I don't know what to
I'm
tell
58.
You, brother. Yeah,
I'm 58 that years young.
You go ARP eligible.
But I have the mind of
the
child. Does that count with Social Security? I have the mind of a child.
I mean, I'm still 12 years old at home in my mind. You know
okay.
what I mean?
So, you're, the entitlements, which are in, if you when you talk about entitlements, you're talking about Social Security and Medicare
and that's Medicaid.
And Medicaid.
Yep,
that's it. And then you got the military on the other side,
right? And that's two-thirds of our federal budget.
Okay,
those four
all
things.
Right. So, but the fact is that can't you get those taken care of by administering these programs more efficiently,
no,
by making them
now
lean,
you
sa-
now
lean
you sound like a
machines.
Republican. Wow. Well, no, Mike O'Barica, the Republican, waste, fraud, and abuse. Let's get rid of it. That's what Republicans always say.
Hold
I love
on,
it.
But I'm not saying because I think that fraud.
You're wrong.
Runs rampant.
You're wrong.
In what do you mean I'm wrong about that? Fraud doesn't run rampant in the Medicare Medicaid system. Do you mean I'm wrong about that?
So if you go back,
doctors do not abuse the Medicare system,
Mike,
and haven't for years.
Would you like an answer?
Yes.
Okay. So the answer is there is waste, fraud, and abuse. You are correct, but as a percentage of how big these programs are, it doesn't touch it. You know, when you look at and I've read Office of Inspector General reports on all these things, you see they compute the fraud. It's certainly
I should be like Donald Trump right now. So have I.
Yeah, right.
No, but I really, I don't
I like
do
to
that.
Read lots of things.
Okay.
But right. No, but, so but my point.
James Patterson. No, go ahead.
I was just quoting Trump, but anyhow, okay, right, I read lots of things. It's a misnomer that I watch TV. I'm always reading papers, lots of papers.
I think I'm getting what you're saying here, which is really the broad strokes are the real strokes, where the fact is that the entitlement programs and the military spend, when you say two-thirds of of the budget, and you know, by
and they're on autopilot. They're on autopilot, right? Like, I mean, military spending you can adjust, but you have to spend for military, you have to spend Social Security, and you have to spend Medicare and Medicaid. Like, you, and unless you're going to make fundamental changes to how we spend that money, you're not going to see. You can't mess with the discretionary spending, that other one-third, and bring things into balance.
And to bring it into balance will require a massive tax increase, not a tax cut.
It would. Well, I don't know how massive it would be, but you would
really?
You would need a tax increase, and you would need spending cuts. You need both of those things. And everybody agrees that if you want to balance a budget, you need to do it's common sense, right? Like, when you're doing your household budget, right? Like, you will cut back on things and bring more money in. That will help you eliminate your
debt,
right?
And whether we get there, it will always. That's the never ending battle. Where I didn't realize it was that simple. Where you had on one side the people that support. Because listen. If anybody's out there saying that the Democrats hate the military, that's not true. If anybody's saying that all Republicans are heartless and don't care about people that are suffering in this country, that's not true either.
Yeah, that's only you, Mike.
The question. No, you're being. What's wrong with you today? I basically think that we have. It's very difficult to get anything done in this country while we have the Clown College at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. When you consider the turnover in staff, when you consider the story of the day is Staff Secretary Rob Porter resigning because two women that he was married to alleged domestic abuse in that situation. And then they throw it in like almost like it doesn't matter. Oh, and by the way, he's dating, there she is again, Hope Hicks.
There she
Hope
is.
Hicks, whose name comes up constantly. It's just chaos. It's chaos, and we're talking about military parades when we're having this impasse again in Washington. it's just, it's overwhelming, Chris. When you think about it, it is truly overwhelming.
It is overwhelming. I've never seen anything like this. I think what was interesting about how they handled this was the effusive praise that came out for Rob Porter before all the facts were out, right? You had John Kelly saying he's a great guy. I don't want him to step down. You had Sarah Sanders from the podium supporting him. And remember the way that that probably came about. Hope Hicks is the communications director. She's his girlfriend. She went and I likely gathered statements from all senior administration officials, got those statements, and then sent them out. And then as the story continued to develop, it was an ex-wife, then it was two ex-wives. And the, you know, the president was aware of this based on the reporting I've seen about a week ago. Other officials have known it for longer because it has held up as FBI clearance because of these issues.
By the way,
issues.
Is this the same Hope Hicks that dated Corey Lewandowski?
I wouldn't say dated, but I would
say... But they had a relationship, right? They had a relationship?
They had encounters.
I mean, the smallest Fortune 500 companies, don't they have a certain criteria for inter-office fraternization?
Some of them do, but some of them do.
But I mean, the fact, and I'm not trying to be sexist here, but it just seems interesting that we have this scandal and then, and they throw this in almost as an afterthought. Oh, by the way, they are dating, and it gets back to the original vetting situation. Was the man vetted?
Well, look, how long by all accounts, he is fantastic at his job. And even his ex-wife, who said, yes, you know, I was abused, also said, I don't want him to lose his job over this. I think he's awesome at his job. But this is a, you know, this is an issue that he has. She said, I wouldn't recommend anybody marry or date him, but I think he should stay in the White House.
Well, I also watch Cops when the guy with his shirt off, gets taken to jail, and then he comes back, and the woman welcomes him back into the home, right? I mean, it's the same kind of situation.
Well,
there.
I mean, I'm not gonna put her on the couch. You know, they're divorced.
Well, I'm also going to give everybody the benefit of the doubt until you see a photograph with a woman with a black eye. With a woman who takes a picture and puts it on, and takes the picture after she has been hit. We're not talking about something where it was just emotional. Not that that's justifiable either, but you're talking about a guy that is, you know, even the most cursory review of his track record would flag this in a presidential administration.
And that's Chris? The question is who in senior White House leadership knew about this and why the over the top statements about how great he was, you know, hours before he ends up resigning. That was, I mean, could not have been bungled more. And that's what, you know, it was kind of a defensive, he's great, we love him, leave him alone. And then he tendered his resignation and everybody said, well, what's that about? It's just another, to your point, Mike, I mean, it's another failure for the Trump White House and the organization. I'd also look to see, you know, there's been chatter about John Kelly. You know, Trump's still telling people that he's unhappy with Kelly. He's unhappy with anybody who is his chief of staff. So that's not
John Kelly. You mean get up off their asses, John Kelly?
In my humble opinion,
who got the ultimate free ride because he was a general. And the fact that came out now and perhaps showed his true stripes to a certain extent. And by the way, I have nothing but respect for the service that he's given his country and the fact that he lost a son serving in the United States military. But when you hear a comment like that, doesn't it play to the reputation this administration has over immigration and the attitude towards people that come from other countries, especially certain countries?
Absolutely it does. And to give our listeners a little bit of context, Kelly was talking to lawmakers on Capitol Hill and he made the point that, look, there's like, you know, the president had given a cap of about 2 million Dreamers to stay in the country. There's only about 680,000 of them who are registered right now. And his point was, well, did people not go register? You know, if they didn't register as Dreamers, then that's on them. They didn't get off their asses. Maybe they were working a day job.
Right.
He said, you know, that's what he said. He said they were lazy. Maybe they were lazy and didn't get off their asses to go register. So that's kind of the context of this. And to your point, I mean,
and it doesn't improve with context either, in my opinion, when you hear him say that. It doesn't.
Oh, no. I mean, like, look, I'm not defending him. I'm just letting folks know who maybe didn't see all the stories that this is what we're talking about.
By the way, can I just interject here with the, you know, the standard line that I've heard come from a lot of people on the right are that, you know,
All Americans are dreamers. We're dreamers, too. Not just those brown people. We're dreamers, too. Okay, I get it. But, I mean, the fact is you're talking about, you know, they have to use the terminology. It always has to be them, those people. And there always has to be that giant wedge when we're forgetting the irrefutable truth that we are a nation of immigrants. And it frustrates me to no end when you hear they or them, or they're not working hard enough, or that, come on, can't all, we get by
all
that
All lives
crap?
Matter, Mike. All lives matter. We're all dreamers.
There you go. That's the same thing.
Yeah, it's
the
same. I mean,
like, if you single out a population in the United States that has had a tougher road to hoe, because they came into this country illegally, and they were brought in illegally when they were babies,
or
when they were children.
In the term of Black Lives Matter, they were brought here as slaves.
If you know your history, and, right. And it just seems to me we don't. It's a short memory.
We've always had a short memory as a culture, though. Whether that's no Irish need apply or without papers for the Italians. I mean, there
absolutely.
Was just. I mean, this is kind of a, you know, shut the door behind you country, right? Like, well, we got in and everybody else stayed.
One of the greatest examples of it in the world. You want to see a movie called Gangs of New York? Check it out sometime and watch. Watch what Butcher Bill says about his fellow Irishmen coming off the boat. Mm-hmm. They are the people that are established in the United States that are now doing better, completely resent the immigrants that are coming off the boat, and they want them banned, and they want them, you know, subjected to lower standards.
It's interesting, Mike.
This is an American condition,
and it happens to this day.
Maybe a human condition.
If you look at folks who consider themselves Chicanos, who have been in this country for, you know, sometimes their families have been here for hundreds of years. They tend to be more conservative, more Republican, and they tend to align a little bit more with Republican policies on immigration than newer Mexican immigrants do. So it's the same
thing.
You
have in Cuban immigrants down in
Florida, right? Yeah, that's another great
ultra conservative.
Exactly.
And anti-Castro, and they line up with and they voted for Trump. Very significant. It was a significant voting bloc in the state of Florida. You have that here. It just, you know, it always seems like no matter what the issues of the day are, we're getting beyond the principled arguments and we're getting back to that main deal, which involves immigrants and those people, and statements like John Kelly made about get off their asses speaks to the underlying feeling among a lot of people in this country that this administration ain't out for people of color.
But I think
that's the way it comes down on my side. I mean, that's what I see.
But I think the other thing that you saw this week, you saw that from the Trump administration, but you also saw Democrats powerless to stop it. And when Nancy Pelosi stands up in the House of Representatives and gives an eight hour filibuster speech, fun fact, only three people in the House have the ability to do that. Everybody else can be gaveled down: Speaker, Majority Leader, and Minority Leader. So she used
it. See, that's a great fact. I didn't realize why she was able to do that. And because she is
She's the
minority leader, she is able to do
you
that.
You can't shut her off. You can shut everybody off.
I have a complex feeling about Nancy Pelosi. I think that Nancy Pelosi has been an amazing target for the right because she allows herself to be. I think she is, at best, a marginal communicator. I don't think she has
not a
charisma.
Good communicator. I would just say it, having sat through Nancy Pelosi press conferences. Not
yes, terrible.
Not a great communicator.
She's terrible. And she is also the face of the Democratic Party when they wanted, you know, Nancy Pelosi and those people.
Sure.
And yet there she is, time and time again, continues to hold her status on the Hill. And it gets to the point where I think the Democratic Party, if they are going to make progress in the midterms and in future elections, they have to have a little more tough love. And, it, you know, you've heard it time and time and time again. This speaks to the response to the State of the Union, where they had Joe Kennedy up there. I thought that was weak. It is time for really a reshuffling, and I'm not sure that Perez and the Republican leadership, I'm sorry, the Democratic leadership is up for the challenge. It doesn't seem like anything's happening.
So,
where is our real front runner in the next presidential race? You don't see it. You hear names bandied about. What is the real status of some of these congressional campaigns? You hear a lot of women are getting involved, that a lot of people are running for Congress that may not have run before, but no one's really getting a
consistent message out? Would that be? And there I am saying bad things about the Democrats. There, but that's the
there,
way. I
there
feel
you have it. So
it frustrates me.
A couple of thoughts there. One, you know, just to finish on the immigration piece. You know, this was a party that said we're going to hold, you know, government funding hostage to get what we want on Dreamers to make sure that they can stay here. They gave up that gamble. You and I talked about it. It was right. Like, oh, they'll deal with it later. Maybe, you know, force another shutdown. Clearly, they're not going to do that. They're not going to use their leverage. And when Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell went into a room to bang out the spending deal, Dreamers came off the table fairly quickly. That's why Nancy Pelosi, who was marginalized in those talks, ended up kind of giving that impassioned speech, you know, trying to play to the left, but really showing that she doesn't have any ability to change that. So she's going to talk a lot about it. To your second point of where the hell are the Democrats? I've been making this point for a long time. And I remember talking to a pretty senior Democrat over lunch once. And I said, why the hell do you guys still have Nancy Pelosi as the minority leader? The answer, Mike, was she can raise a ton of money. That was the answer. Of course, any
minority, there you have it. There's American politics.
There's America. And you know, there's a lot of truth to that. I think any minority leader could raise money. She's very good at it. But when, to your point, when you look at the bench, right, you have Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, Jim Clyburn. I mean, they're all in their 70s or older. I mean, like, there are members of the House. I think of Chris Van Hollen, right? A young guy who ran for Congress from the state legislature in Maryland about 15 years ago, came into the House, you know, got a senior seat on the budget committee, you know, was kind of trying to move up, and then he hit that ceiling. And he just bounced and ran for Senate. Now he's a senator because there is no up there. And I do think that the Democratic Party needs to, needs to allow that next generation to rise up. But I don't think they're. But I don't think they're going to find it. I don't think they're going to find it in Washington. This is my point.
I will tell you this. If they don't rise up, especially now, this is an opportunity. Right now, if they don't make room for these people in the Democratic Party. I hate saying Democrat Party. Sorry about that. I thought I was watching Fox News. The thing is, if they don't do it, they're going to miss the opportunity of opportunities. And what I'm not seeing, and people have talked about this, I'm not seeing cohesion on that side.
But I don't think you're going to see cohesion on House races. I mean, any head of the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, will tell you that you should run very local races, that you should run in your district, and you don't see – that's why it's hard to cover congressional races. That's why midterms aren't as sexy as a presidential, because there's all these kind of micro races happening and you have to run for your district. And so the national messaging matters less. But I think where Democrats need to go.
But you are having a lot of congressional Republicans that are dropping out, not running. A lot of seats are going to be in play in these midterms. So are you telling me, based on that, that you don't feel that having a national message, being on message nationally, is relevant to some of these congressional races?
I think it's
races.
Dangerous. I think they should play
so
to their district.
So they should keep it local, local, local.
Absolutely.
What about the missteps of the Trump administration? You think that'll play a factor in some of these races?
If depending on how the district looks. If it's a district that went for Trump, probably not, right? If it's a swing district that, you know, was close and Hillary won by a little bit, maybe it does, right? Like so that's why you don't want to have a national message when it comes to the House of Representatives. But my other point is, I think they should be looking for leaders who are big city mayors, who are governors, who are up and coming and have something to show.
Reality show stars. Hey, it worked for them.
I would advise against that if you want people who know how to govern, as we are now seeing. I know you'll make a joke. The idea being... The guys like
I
that
like
much.
Big city mayors.
Big
like,
city mayors, governors, people who have done something to say, look what we did. You know, we helped bring down the homeless population. We helped, with a healthcare exchange that we did in our city or our state. Like there are ways to show that you're doing something. And Democrats in Washington, no matter what they say, aren't really doing anything because they're not.
I agree with you as far as some of these congressional races. I agree with this with Nat, putting people on the national stage. However, it's real hard for me, and I'll say this to you, and you're probably going to mock me for it, but it's real hard for me every time I see Uncle Joe Biden to not wish that man was on the national stage. There's something about him that just appeals to me, and I'm not quite sure.
It's his Camaro. I bet it's his topless Camaro.
It's the fact that he rode the train all those years and talked to people, and I went to see him speak in Sarasota, Florida. There's something about Joe Biden that I enjoy. With that said, if there's somebody we can put on the national stage that's a flavor of the month that is going to be bigger than that, that will take the mantle, I'm all for it.
Here's the issue, Mike. Your party made that next to impossible by clearing the way for Hillary Clinton last cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And, right. you know, when you had Bernie Sanders, you know, stumble down out of the Senate and hold a press conference outside of the Senate chambers. I'm running for president. Yeah. No more questions. I have to go vote. Like, that was basically.
Oh, hey, you just did an impression. Yeah. Bernie Sanders. Yeah. Yeah.
Get off my lawn. Free health care. Free education, everything. Nobody's paying. I saw a lot of Sanders too during the campaign.
I understand. Mr. Objective, that's a window into his soul right there when he describes Bernie Sanders. That shows you where
that's
he's
it. That was his platform. I mean, that was an objective platform. Just everything should be free, and all the kids were like, "That sounds good."
Yeah. But there's enough wealth to pay for it in the United States. That's the way I look at it. You know, come on, you got
tax
with,
Mike O'Mara,
40,000 square foot homes in the Hamptons. Okay, we can spare some change for the rabble out here. That's the way I look at it. But that's another story. Let me get us back on track. All right. The fact is, because we are all over the place and we spent too much time talking about money. I don't want to talk. I want to talk about
couples
hair.
Fight over money, and I see it happening here.
I want to talk more about bad hair days that like the president had, but we don't have time this week because we do. Yeah. Everybody saw that walking up there, and you know what? There you go. I'll give you one little thing that'll show you I'm balanced too. I'm with you on the Nancy Pelosi thing.
Oh, absolutely.
To see some new blood.
Lots of
Democrats
like
to see
are.
Some fresh faces, and there are plenty of people that are running, and I just hope there's some new blood in Congress after the midterms. And that, you know what? That applies to moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans, and people on the left and the right. If you get new faces, new ideas, that's never really a bad thing. Now, before we get out of here, you have been very, very excited about our listener mail, that people are communicating with you, Chris Freites, because you're young and exciting, not old and tired.
And so I actually use Twitter. I mean, unlike you.
That's
like people
right.
tag you all
Twitter.
The time,
that's
and I've not seen you reply
new.
Once.
Don't respond to it. If you want to get to me, you got to send it Pony Express down here to Southwest Florida. That's how it works. Just send me an old, you know, put a wax stamp on it. That's how you correspond with Mike O'Mara. But you've got some listener mail.
I got some listener week. Mail. Thank you guys for writing in. It's always good to hear from you. Mike won't talk to you, but I will. I'm the one who loves you. Don't forget it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Nicholas Marr, he says that I love the new Mike Overreacts to Listener Mail segment of Political Persuasions podcast.
That is completely outrageous.
Because you felt so backhanded with the compliment last week. So mm-hmm. he enjoyed that quite
all right,
a bit.
Very good. Happy
Geekster Dad says... he wants to know regarding the Eagles win and political persuasion, what will the White House reaction be to the Eagles who said that the pregame, you know, before the game that they weren't going to visit the White House if they won? This is an interesting question.
That's a good question. That's a really, really good question.
It's a really good question.
I'm curious about that myself.
Yeah. And to set it up for our listeners, there were a number of Eagles, Chris Long, Brandon, a couple of other guys who basically said, I'm not going to go down there. And if you remember back to the season, the beginning of the season with all the kneeling that happened, the Eagles took a different route. And it was interesting to watch this because the Eagles, instead of individuals taking a knee, they all decided that they would stand together, arms locked together, the owners, the coaches, the players, military and police to protest. And so that's how they decided to protest. So now there's mm-hmm. a question whether the Eagles as a team will decide not to go to the White House.
Do you think they're going to go?
You know, if any team might not go, I think it's the Eagles. And Jeffrey Lurie, I think part of the reason this team is such a good team on the football field is because they are a real team. It's not a collection of individuals who happen to be talented and they can get the job done individually. They really are a cohesive unit. And I would be interested to see if they do go. Obviously, if they slight Trump, I expect tweets about how the Eagles are the worst and they're terrible and they're unpatriotic and they hate everybody.
It'll be interesting to watch. It'll be because, I mean, I think if they're, you know, it's a dilemma. If you've got two or three guys on the team that want to go to the White House and want to support the president and are excited about going to the White House, as a lot of these guys are, it's going to be kind of sad.
You can make the argument like, look, you know, it's the White House. It doesn't really matter who the occupant is.
I might make that argument. As much as I understand the protests, I might make that argument. I think that, you know, it's the office, and yes, it is. It is occupied by that gentleman. I think perhaps they raise the bar for themselves and they go and they show up. I think that would be more powerful than if they didn't. And I think if they don't, it's going to feed into, you know, everything that we do in this country.
That's a good question. I don't know how I feel about that. I think either way makes a statement. It would be interesting if they go and talk about, you know, visiting the White House, but that they don't agree with all the policies. I don't know how they'll handle it. There's a number of ways to handle it.
I'll be curious. Now you got me watching it.
But it's certainly something we'll watch. Geekster Dad also wants you to know that it's pronounced Nunez, not Nunez. So
yes, I did say Nunez last week.
Which also, you're not alone. Chuck Schumer did the same thing.
Nunez. It's Nunez.
Exactly. Yeah, so
like high noon.
So congressman nobody knew about, you know, did the memo thing, and now everybody knows about him is mispronouncing his name. That's our mailbag.
Okay, very good. That's it, and that's Political Persuasion. So Nunez and Rob Porter can go get a steak somewhere, and you know, and do that. Anyway, I'm sorry. That's just a little dig there that I threw in at the very end. That is another episode of Political Persuasions that flies by. I know you want us to expand to an hour, but you know what? Get us more downloads, and we'll expand to an hour.
I like that deal. That's a deal.
Okay, you get us more downloads, we will expand to 1 hour. We will be back. Who knows what's going to happen next week? It's always something. We got to a third of what happened this week.
We did. We didn't even touch on the trader stuff.
We didn't even touch on the stock market at all.
I know.
Enjoy the bumpy ride. I'll be calling my broker right after the show. For Mr. Chris Freitz, this is Mike O'Mara. We'll see you next time on Political Persuasion. You sell your countrymen, and yet we know your name.
Traitor, traitor. Thank you for listening to another episode of Political Persuasions. If you have a comment or question for Political Persuasions, please send it to @Freitz on Twitter. That's F-R-A-T-E-S. Thank you. You can download Political Persuasions on iTunes, MikeOmaraShow.com, Stitcher, and wherever fine podcasts are found. Mike O'Mara, Radio Entertainment.